It's time now for Alaska Tracks, an oral history of Alaska people and their way of life, celebrating the rich heritage, wild landscapes, and deeply rooted stories of Alaska past. Alaska Tracks, brought to you by Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Rod's Saw Shop. And now your host, respected wildlife biologist and outdoorsman, Randy Zarnke.
Welcome to another episode of Alaska Tracks, the program where we listen to selections of oral history interviews with veteran Alaskan hunting guides, trappers, pilots, and biologists. This project has been conducted by the Alaska Trappers Association over the past 30 years, and we have over 200 interviews in our collection. Hi, I'm your host, Randy Zarnke, and today we'll be listening to portions of our interview with Jim Reardon. Jim had a variety of jobs. He worked as a wildlife professor at UAF. He was a biologist for the Department of Fish and Game, but he's most widely known as an author. In my humble opinion, Jim was simply the best outdoor writer our state has ever known. Two of his most famous books were Alaska's Wolfman, about Frank Glazer, and Shadows on the Koyukuk, about Sidney Huntington. In several of our earlier episodes of this series, we heard short segments weaved together by my commentary. With Jim, almost every word is valuable and interesting. Therefore, we're going to just let it run. Let's start with Jim's memories of his first job as a stream guard back in 1947.
Well, I'm Jim Reardon. I live in Homer. I've been in Homer since 1956. I came to Alaska in 1947 to work for the Fish and Wildlife Service as a fishery patrol agent. They took me to Chignik and assigned me a 30-foot double-ender patrol boat. It was probably built in the 20s. It was Port Orford cedar planking, and it had a two-cylinder, 16-horse Regal gas engine. And it had a great big flywheel on it, and on top of the head were two brass priming cups. You wanted to start the engine, well, you opened a valve on the priming cups and poured raw gas in it, closed the two valves, you retarded the spark, gave it a little gas, and then there was a great big bar that you would insert on the face of the flywheel. It was shaped like a butcher knife, round on one side and flat on the other and rounded on the end, and you pulled it over and it would sometimes start and sometimes it wouldn't. It was a hard starting thing, and once it started, why, it would shake and rattle, but it was a slow speed engine. One of the amusing things that happened, I was the grunt or the assistant. The guy in charge of Chignik that year was Tarleton F. Smith, and I worked for him. Well, T, his nickname, was not too familiar with boats. I'd served in the Navy, and I'd been on small boats when I was a kid. I was pretty familiar with boats. I didn't have any problems running this one. He decided he wanted to learn how to run that engine, and I showed him. I said, now be sure to retard the spark when you start it. He decided to try to start it one day, and he went through the whole routine. Well, he didn't retard it quite far enough and pulled it over, and it backfired, and this 7 or 8 pound piece of steel flew past his head and embedded itself in the overhead in the cabin of that boat. He never went near that engine again the rest of the summer. I was at the time a student in fish and game management at Oregon State. I was a junior. I returned for my senior year. At the end of my senior year, I was awarded an assistantship at the Cooperative Wildlife Research Unit at the University of Maine at Orono. So I went back there and spent 2 years working on a master's degree. And I worked as a lab assistant and instructed some classes and helped with research that Howard Mendel was doing, and worked with other fellows who were also doing master's work. Graduated with an MS in 1950, at which time an announcement came out that the University of Alaska Fairbanks had formed a cooperative wildlife research unit. There were, I think, 13 of them at land-grant colleges around the country at the time. Part of the arrangement is that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service provides the leader of the unit, and the university provides the housing, and they provide an undergraduate program in fish and game management. Dr. Neil Hosley was the leader of the unit at the time, and announcement went out that they were looking for someone to go to Fairbanks to teach wildlife management. Well, I applied for it, and to my amazement, I was given the job. My job was to organize the wildlife department and teach, which I did. Part of the reason I think I got the job is I'd been to Alaska previously. But I learned later that Alaska didn't appeal to people. It was just the opposite with me. Gee, when I was in high school, I'd heard about Alaska, and I was going to come up here and start a beef ranch and homestead. Oh, I had all big ideas. You know, when you're 15 or 16, why, you don't know what life is all about. So I taught for 4 years. I'm rather proud of the students that I had at the time. They were really the cream of the crop. Most of them were veterans studying on the GI Bill, just as I had. Two of them, Jim Brooks, Ron Skoog, later became commissioners of Fish and Game. George Schaller worked for the New York Zoological Society and became world famous for his work with gorillas and pandas and the snow leopard. Tom Cade became head of the ornithology department at Cornell. People like Bob Hinman became assistant directors of game, and there were graduate students that I worked with, Cal Lensink and Dave Klein, who became leader at the unit at Fairbanks at the university, John Hakala, who wound up working on the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, and others who did equally well. But teaching wasn't for me. I always felt that the students were smarter than I was, and I had to work hard to stay ahead of them, and I wasn't sure I was always ahead of them. And I'd stand up in that main building in the classroom, and I could look across the Tanana Flats at the Alaska Range, and I'd be lecturing, and I'd wonder, what the hell am I doing here with all that wonderful country and all the adventures that a guy can have out there? So after about 2 years, I ran into an old guy by the name of Frank Glazier. He came to Alaska in 1915, was a market hunter along the Richardson Highway, and then he moved to Savage River near McKinley Park, where he was a trapper for many years. And in 1937, he went to work as a predator control agent for the then Biological Survey, which turned into the Fish and Wildlife Service. And old Frank was a storyteller. He was wonderful at telling stories. He had wonderful stories. He had so many experiences throughout Alaska. And he had the respect of the old-timers. He was a sourdough that the old-timers really knew as a capable woodsman. I started writing stories with Frank and sold a bunch of them. That gave me enough courage to resign my professorship, which in retrospect was probably very foolish, because I could have stayed there and taught and been a sinecure and retired with a big retirement. But as it was, I wanted adventure and change, and I got it. As a result, when I left the job teaching and started writing, I'd sold about a dozen stories to Outdoor Life and 8 or 10 to other national magazines. In order to support my family, I started guiding. One of the trips that I had taken in the time I was a teacher was a summer jaunt to the Koyukuk Valley. One of the graduate students, a fellow by the name of Bert Libby, who had been a student at Maine when I was there, and when an opening occurred, I told him to apply for it, and he did and got the position. He was working with beaver. And at the time, there was a bag limit for trappers of beaver on the Koyukuk, and word kept coming in that they were very numerous, that the bag limit needed to be changed. And at the time, the Game Commission was the body that made the regulations for hunting and fishing and trapping. Ray Wolford was the local protection officer or Fish and Wildlife Service agent at the time. He loaded Bert Libby and I into an L1 Stinson on floats. We took a Grumman aluminum canoe, and he tied it on the spreader bars between the floats upright. He managed to get the airplane into the air, but he couldn't get it over about 200 feet. The canoe was spoiling the air, and he wasn't getting the lift he needed. So he had to land. We took it off, and we had a link canoe. And there's a kind of an interesting sequel to that. A link canoe is, I think there were 2, 4, 6, 8 pieces that snapped together, and then a canvas cover was pulled over it. And it would fit into the L1. He flew us clear up into the Hooslea River. We drifted down the Hooslea River, counting beaver, life trapping a little bit. Actually, Bert put a few ear tags in beaver, and probably to the bewilderment of some of the native trappers at the time. And we wound up at Hooslea, the village. And the village had just recently moved. They had a brand new log schoolhouse that the villagers had built. We stayed in the log schoolhouse for several days. Jack Sackett, the trader, had a radio, and he got a message from Fairbanks that the L1 was laid up and we were to return to Fairbanks with Ween Airlines. Well, Andy Anderson was flying for Ween out of Bettles at the time. He showed up flying a 170 on floats, and we flew to Bettles with him. But it was going to be the next day before there was a DC-3 to Fairbanks. And he didn't know us from Adam. But he said, "Have you guys got a moose yet?" And we said, "No." He said, "Why don't you take my riverboat and run upriver?" We ran up the John River. We got into some of the foothills of the Brooks Range. And this is the country that really impressed me. I was in love with the Brooks Range and that area from the start. And we got a moose. We got a small moose. And came back down river. And I remember asking Hannah Anderson, Andy's wife, for some used old sheets that I would send her new ones that we could wrap the meat in to throw it aboard that DC-3. I mentioned the canoe that Bert Libby and I used. Many years later, in the 70s, President Ford appointed me to the National Advisory Committee on Oceans and Atmosphere. And this came as a result of Clem Tillian, who lives across the bay, had been on the committee for some time and had to resign because he was still in the legislature and it was taking too much time, and he'd recommended me for the position. One of the members of that committee when I was there was Ed Link, inventor of the Link canoe and inventor of the Link aircraft trainer that was so key to training pilots for instrument flying during World War II. The Link canoe had a problem. It had a rough canvas cover, and it wouldn't glide. Boy, you earned every foot that you gained with it. And I asked Ed Link, I said, "Ed, what caused you to invent that thing?" I said, "It's a good canoe, except that it's a tough bugger to paddle." He says, "Boy, it sure was, wasn't it?" And he said, "Well, I invented that because I had a Widgeon airplane, and I wanted a canoe that I could put inside the airplane." And that's the way it worked. It was great for that because it kind of nested. The pieces would nest, and you have this canvas cover that you'd pull over it.
That was a great sequence of stories from Jim. Now let's take a short break and hear from our sponsors. Okay, we're back from the break. Now let's hear some more memories from today's guest, Jim Reardon.
See, I left the job at the university in 1954. I taught for 4 years. And I moved to Homer because I liked the ocean, and Homer has a lot to offer. And at the time, the interior climate was not as mild as it is these days. We had a lot of 50 and 60 below months and winters. And that kept your activity down quite a bit. I got to Homer, and I had to just do whatever I could to bring in a few bucks. I'd been struggling, trying to keep alive. Writing is not a real high-paying job, but it wasn't for me anyway. I had to rent a house, and I had a wife, and by then I had 3 kids, 2 daughters and a son. I had worked as a carpenter in Homer. I worked as a clerk in a trading post. I spent one summer hunting hair seals for the $3 bounty on the hides that I sold, and writing all this time and developing relationships with editors. Outdoor life was my major market. As of now, I've sold 55 or 56 major pieces to Outdoor Life, but I haven't written for them for several years. For 20 years, I was listed on the masthead with Outdoor Life as a field editor. And in 1959, the Territorial Department of Fisheries was delegated the job by the Fish and Wildlife Service to oversee a seismic exploration program in Cook Inlet. Four seismic vessels from Gulf of Mexico were brought up by Standard Oil, several other major companies. They were to use black powder explosives, along with dragging their geophones through the water. The requirement by the federal government, the Fish and Wildlife Service, was to have an overseer, someone to see that they didn't damage any valuable fisheries. The Territorial Department of Fisheries hired me to do that job. They assigned the Jaguar, which is a steel cannery boat from Kodiak. It's about a 60-footer, 70-footer. And we followed the seismic boats around as they exploded the black powder. And it was the most boring job in the whole world. They went up so far as to actually went in a Turnagain arm with this operation. And they operated mostly out of Seldovia. In the spring, they moved down and operated off of Icy Bay. And I accompanied them down there. When I returned from Icy Bay, they'd chartered a DC-3 to bring a bunch of stuff down, and it came back empty to Anchorage, and the job was over. I was the only passenger in that DC-3 all the way from Yakutat to Anchorage, and I had a 4x5 speed graphic with me, my camera. The pilot was flying all over and turning here and there so I could get good pictures with that speed graphic. I've still got 4x5 color transparencies of some of the glaciers and things that I took on that trip. But that job actually tended into a position with the state in 1959. Fish and Wildlife Service was to manage salmon fisheries and other fisheries for the last season. And the new state, which was going to take over in 1960, was to establish their controls. Bud Weberg was the area biologist then assigned to Cook Inlet, and the headquarters was at Homer for commercial fisheries. Well, Bud hired me as his assistant. That summer, we flew with the Fish and Wildlife Service and followed their procedures in managing the salmon fishery. They had a Grumman goose that they flew out of Anchorage, and that was their main management effort. They would fly over the fishery, pick up salmon fish tickets, and that was it. And in those days, of course, the regulations for salmon fishing were established the previous winter, and the only way they could be changed was to publish a change in the Congressional Register, which took a minimum of 72 hours and had to be an extremely important biological change or necessity before they would do it. As a result, of course, over the years, the salmon fishery had gone to hell. 1959, the last year of federal management, the catch in Alaska totaled 25 million salmon. These days, if we don't get 150 to 200 million, it's an off year. The state has built this fishery back. Weberg left the job in, I think, 1962, and I was offered the job as area biologist, and of course I took it. And I lasted 10 years until I was offered the job as outdoors editor for Alaska Magazine. But the first few years of management of salmon, especially, were kind of a key. The commissioner delegated to area biologists the authority to use field announcements to open and close salmon fishing seasons. And this gave us the flexibility to stop a fishery when it was threatening a good escapement. And when there was an abundance of fish, we could allow the fishermen to take what was available. And boy, if you don't think this wasn't popular with the fishermen after all the years of federal management. Some of the interesting things that happened. One of the fellows who was a fisherman, well, he's gone now, Ben Sudeth, his name was. And he was well known for his ability to get behind the markers with a seine. And he admitted it to me. I remember being down at Nuka Bay on a stream survey flight, and one of the streams was absolutely plugged with pink salmon, and Ben Sudeth was anchored nearby. Well, I knew as soon as it was dark where Ben was going to hit that stream, but we had more fish than we needed in the stream anyway. So I landed, went out and pulled the markers, and Ben came roaring up. He said, "What's going on? Who are you?" And I told him, I said, "Help yourself, Ben." I knew who he was. He said, "What do you mean, help myself?" I said, "The stream is open." I said, "Just don't go up the creek. We need the spawners." "Honest to God," he said. That was a good year. We had pink salmon all over the place. At the end of the season, I had a phone call from Ben Sudeth from Seward. He said, "Jim, this is the first year that I have ever fished legally throughout the whole season." And he said, "It's the best year I've ever had." Well, another poacher, guy who was famed for hitting the streams, was on his way past Anderson Lake, which is on the outer Kenai Peninsula coast. It has a small run of red salmon. He went by Anderson Lake and turned back, and there's a big school of red salmon trying to get in the stream, but there's a log jam, and they couldn't get through. And the season was open. He called me on the radio, told me about the log jam. He said, "I'll tell you what," he said, "if you get a crew down here to clear this log jam, I'll stand by here and guard these fish till you get here," which he did. So I sent a couple temporaries down there with a chainsaw, and they cleaned it out in a short time, and the fish ran up, and this guy just went on down to Port Dick, which is where he was headed. That would never have happened under federal management. It worked in those early years very, very well. I'm going to brag a little. One of the things I'm most proud of, Cook Inlet has a lot of silty streams. The Kenai River, the Kasilof, the Susitna, and there are others. Trying to get escaping figures in these streams is almost impossible with the way that it used to be done. They used to put a fish wheel in to sample it. Or they'd put a gill net in, or they would seine. Actually, some of the cannery superintendents would stand and count jumpers, how many jumpers they'd see in 10 minutes, and report that as an indication of the abundance of fish. Well, it meant nothing. During World War II, I was trained as a sonar operator. I served aboard a destroyer escort in the Central Pacific. My job was to locate Jap subs so we could drop depth charges on them. I remembered my sonar training, and I talked to Commissioner Walt Kirkness. He was the second commissioner of the Fish and Game Department after Statehood. Andy Anderson was the first. And I told Walt, "I think these fish could be counted with a sonar machine." He said, "Well, why don't you look into it?" He said, "I'll back you." So I wrote to every sonar company in the United States. At the time, there weren't many Jap sonar companies. Only one company answered, Bendix. And they sent a fellow by the name of Al Menon up here. Al was a genius, electronics genius. He showed up here in the fall. And I had a fellow working for me as a temporary that summer by the name of Ray Baxter. And Baxter was trained at Humboldt State and later became a commercial fishery biologist in Cordova. Then he was at Bethel for the ADF&G. And his wife has a set net site over at McDonald's Spit right now. And she's been there for many, many years. And she also had a degree in wildlife. That summer, I'd hired the two of them as temporaries, as a team. Anyway, I assigned Ray to help this sonar guy. And he went up to the Kasiluf River and set it up in the river, but there were no fish running. So Ray, who was a crackerjack of an outdoorsman, went over to Crooked Creek and caught some silvers. And he put them on a line and dragged them in front of the sonar counter in the silty water. Well, the sonar bounces off of the fish bladders, the air. That's where the echo comes from. And though these fish were dead, they simulated live fish perfectly well. Menon came back. He said, I can build you a salmon sonar counter. And he did. So every salmon sonar counter in the state now is a result of my idea. I'm the grandfather. Interestingly, 3 years ago, my grandson, Stephen Reardon, was hired by ADF&G to run a sonar counter over in the Kuskokwim country, and Menon, who still comes to Alaska, went over there to check on it. But I'd like to have seen his face when he found out that Stephen was my grandson.
That brings us to the end of today's episode, but that's not the last you'll hear of Jim Reardon. He talked long enough in our interview that we have sufficient material for a second episode with Jim. So tune in again next week when we return with a second episode with this great storyteller.
You have been listening to Alaska Tracks, a blend of interviews, storytelling, and firsthand accounts from Alaskans who know the land and carry forward the traditions of this remarkable state. Alaska Tracks has been brought to you by Ginger Orem with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Rod Sawshaw. Join us next Saturday for another episode of Alaska Tracks, about Alaskans, for Alaskans, by Alaskans.